January 16th, 1985. This is Yetta Chaikin taping Harry David Zutz for the Jewish Historical Society of Delaware, January 16th, 1985. Harry, where were you born?
I was born in Wilmington, Delaware.
And when?
On December the 12th, 1917.
Who were your parents?
My parents were David Zutz and Mary Willis Zutz.
Can you tell us something about your early days?
Well, my early days were spent as most people of our generation were, in a middle-class neighborhood. I lived at 1309 Orange Street, which is now, in these days, directly opposite where the new Hercules building is, which was only a few blocks from where my father's shop was, which meant that he could come home for lunch and dinner, and it was a family experience in that respect. But other than that, he worked maybe 12 hours a day.
What did your father do?
My father was a tailor.
And what kind of clientele? What?
Well, he had a store on Delaware Avenue, and he had a very wealthy clientele, DuPonts and carpenters and Raskobs, and people who lived in the neighborhood, and he was very well known and very well liked by the people who patronized him.
You were Jewish.
Yes.
And being Jewish, it colored your life somewhat. Your early days. Do you remember any relationship between being Jewish and growing up?
Well, of course, when I was little, I didn't think there was any difference because I didn't know any difference. And it was only as I became older that I recognized that being Jewish had some great disadvantages in terms of our not being as well received by the non-Jewish community as we would hoped that they might.
Did you have experiences when you were young to...
Well, when I was young, I was taunted by the bullies in school as the Christ killers and all of the usual penelope of things that went with those who were bigoted. And people didn't even know what bigoted meant. Anti-Semitic was a word. Bigoted wasn't really a word because blacks were supposed to be kept in their place. So it was only Jews that were singled out. Everybody understood that blacks had no rights. Jews were white and theoretically had rights. But because they were Jews, they were deprived of those rights.
Did you have a religious school education?
No, unfortunately I was ill. And as a kid, and I never got to go to Hebrew school, which most of my friends did, and I used to have a man that used to come to the house and gave me religious instruction, and he was called a Malamed. It was a term, I guess it's hardly used these days, but it was a kind of an itinerant rabbi who used to come to the house for a very nominal sum, and he gave me lessons every day in Hebrew and Yiddish.
You mentioned your illness. What happened? How old were you?
Well, when I was about 4 years old, I fell off of a bicycle, and I developed in today's term, nothing. It was a bone infection. It's called osteomyelitis. In those years, there was no way of treating infections, and what they did is they operated on me many, many, many times. And they scraped the bone, and they packed it, and they put me in a cast, and they hoped that it would all go away and everything would be hunky-dory. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way, and they did it 21 times. But I was lucky. I was a survivor. Many people in those years had legs amputated, and because there was no other way that they could treat them.
And so how did that change your childhood?
Well, my childhood was kind of sheltered. I never was able to participate in sports as other kids did. And I missed 2 years of school. And there was a a woman that used to come to the house in the Board of Education occasionally, and she brought me some books and things, but there was no formal method of providing an educational experience as we know it today. But I did make up all but 1 year, and I wound up a year behind the class that I was originally supposed to be in.
Do you think that staying in bed in any way contributed to your interest in reading, or did you develop any?
It probably did. I mean, there was nothing else to do, and I was an avid reader then, and I am to this day. And it was a matter of interest, and there was no end to the kind of things that interested me. And as a result of whatever books were available, that's what I read. And I stayed home month after month and year after year, and I did a tremendous amount of reading. Even radio was not a factor in those years, so reading was the only possible alternative.
When you where did you go to school? What were your schools?
I started in it was called Number 2 School. It was 11th and Washington. That's now a vacant lot directly opposite where the YMCA is now. And then ultimately, that school was phased out, and I went to Number 24 School, which is at 14th and Washington, where the present Board of Education building is now at 14th and Washington. Then I went to Warner, which was a brand new school located on 18th and Van Buren. Then I went to Wilmington High School, which was at the period of Wilmington High School being the most crowded school that there was. And we went in shifts, and that was quite an experience. You either went from 7:30 in the morning until 12 o'clock, or you went from 12:20 until 4:30. And I went there for 2 years, and then they were in the process of building Fiesta Point, and I was the first June graduating class at Fiesta Point.
What year was that?
1936.
And so your schooling was uneventful?
Yes, my schooling was uneventful, other than the fact that I was very appreciative of those kids that were very kind to me, because I was on crutches a good part of the time, and some kids were really great and used to carry books and stuff such as that. But lifestyles were different, and people were not expected to be waited upon. I walked on crutches, you know, back and forth to school, and that was not considered any great hardship.
How far was school?
When I went to PS, I lived on 14th Street, and it was on 34th. It was 22 blocks.
And you walked on crutches?
And I walked, and I did at times on crutches. I did them part when I was better. I didn't go on crutches. But the trolley car cost 8 cents, and it was only 20 blocks, and we walked.
What was your state of economic, your father's...
Well, in those years, you know, the formative years of my life were the years of the Depression years. My father, for me, unfortunately, was rather affluent up until 1931, at which time he lost everything, as many other people did, and at which time we were relegated to a very middle-class lifestyle. And while my father at one time had owned property, etc., I remember distinctly when the Haverly house that we lived in was taken by sheriff sale, and that was the last thing that he owned. And we lived in that same house, and we rented it from the very nice man who originally owned it. His name was Frank Shin, and I was grateful to him all of my life. He allowed us to live in that house until my father was able to buy it back. And then by then I was through high school, and I had a strong desire to go to college, but I didn't have any money. But somehow or another, I managed to go to college. And I worked at various odd jobs and did all kinds of things. And
where did you go to college?
I went to the University of Delaware, and that was the only option that was open to me. I really always wanted to go to only one school. I wanted to go to Oberlin.
Why?
Well, it was a very liberal school in those years when liberality was not well received in the East Coast and other schools, and Oberlin was a progressive liberal school. But that was all a fantasy, because there was no way in the world that I could afford to go to Oberlin. So I went to University of Delaware, where the costs were maybe $300-$400 a year for the whole year. And I wound up owing some of the money. And as a matter of fact, when people talk about your highlights of your educational life, 2 or 3 days before graduation, I was called into the business administrator's office and told that if I didn't have a check in, I couldn't be graduated. So I gave him a check, but what they didn't know is the check was not good.
I'm sure they found out sooner
later.
What did you study at the university?
Well, what I wanted to be is I wanted to be a lawyer, and I started out and I took pre-law, and I was determined that I would somehow or another get to law school. But one of the things that was facing me were really two. Number one, I didn't have any money, and that was very important. And number two, the possibility of becoming a lawyer and passing the bar. So while I was in college, I went to visit various people who I thought might help me, be willing to help me in terms of getting to law school. And I had a lot of lip service, but I didn't have very much help. And I went to a man, his name was Harry Craig, and he was a vice president of the Wilmington Trust Company. He was a fantastic man, and he listened to me very attentively, and did something that very few people had ever done for me up to that point. He said, listen, it's almost lunchtime, I'd like to take you lunch. And we did. And we went to the YWCA, they have a cafeteria. And he said, you don't want to go to law school. And I said, oh, Mr. Craig, I went to go to law school desperately. And he said, no, you don't. Because they're going to break your heart. If you go to law school, they won't let you pass anyway. And I said, this is America. Things like that don't happen. And he said, son, I hate to say this to you, but I'm telling you, they won't let you pass. They haven't let many others like you pass.
Did he mean because you were Jewish?
Yes.
And do you think that would have happened? I mean, you don't
yes,
know.
Yes, because there was a period of almost 20 years when not one Jew passed the bar. And I guess that I would have been in about the same position that they were. Mm. So at any rate, it wasn't his advice I took. And then I went to see Mrs. Alfred I. DuPont, who unfortunately had just, quote, exhausted all of her funds for education. So that was another one that I missed on, although she told me some of the people that she had helped. The last one she had helped was Colin Seitz, who was just ahead of me. But unfortunately, that was it, and I couldn't get any help from her either. So I was relegated to being a college graduate without any particular skills. I changed to business administration, and that's how I was graduated from college.
So you graduated in the School of Business.
Mm-hmm.
Did this experience of not being able to go to law school color your future life in any way?
Well, it was a great disappointment, because I really thought that that's what I was really qualified to do, and I thought that I would have made a good lawyer, but I couldn't do it. So I set out to try to do something else, and I came out of school and I desperately looked for a job, and they had a man at the University of Delaware who was in charge of, his name was Ashbridge, and he was I forget what they called the office, but he was in charge of
employment.
Yeah. And the best he could do for me is he finally, I don't think he tried really very hard, to be truthful. But what he did is he got me two interviews. He got me an interview with Panopec Oil, and I could have either been a, maybe, been a bookkeeper in the jungles of Venezuela. That was one option. And the second was to go to work at Macy's in New York, prospectively as what they call a section manager, which is really not much better than a stock boy. And neither of them were very satisfactory, and I didn't take either of them, and I stayed in Wilmington, and I tried to get a job. And I tried desperately. Now, my father had warned me during my high school, my college days, that I ought to take education, because education was a great, great opportunity. It was a, you got a job, it was a steady job, paid $2,500 a year, and you could have a job for life. Well, that didn't appeal to me, and I never did that. When I came out, I started looking for a job. But having said that, I always had jobs. I drove a truck, I sold door-to-door, I sold vacuum cleaners, I sold shoes, I sold clothing.
When did you do all this?
Well, I was in college. So I had lots of experiences, and even though I was unemployed, I was making as much money at that point as those people who were employed. I certainly was making $35 or $40 a week, which was probably as much as my father was making in that time. But at any rate, I was unemployed and I was looking for a job, but I always had these extra jobs. And then I almost got a job with DuPont Company, and I finally did get a job, a job offer with DuPont Company, which I turned down because they offered me $65 a month to start. Now,
How did you get the job, considering they weren't hiring Jews at that time?
Well, my father had a very good friend, and his name was Donald R. Morton, who was a fabulous guy, and he was special director of personnel. And he really did try for me, and he really got me a job. And he was about to introduce me to my boss when I decided that one of the things I ought to do is I ought to find out how much he's going to pay me. And I had a great deal of trouble reconciling myself to the fact that I should even ask. But I decided to ask, and I did ask. And he said, he looked at me a little bit disapprovingly, and he said, $65. And I said, a week? He said, no, son, a month. And I said, a month? And he started walking slow. I started walking slow and he's walking fast. And he finally turned around and he said, there's something wrong? And I said, yes, Mr. Morton, I better think this over. And I never did go to work for DuPont. And if anybody ever listens to this, Irv Shapiro, please know that I beat you by many, many years.
Except that he did work for them and you didn't.
Right.
But what actually did they offer you in terms of work?
Oh, it was a good job. I was going to be in the cellophane sales division. And it's hard to believe, but cellophane was a brand new product in 1940. Mm-hmm. And that's where I was going to work. So I left there and I didn't go to work for them. And I was still looking for something to do, but unfortunately I didn't have capital, so I couldn't go into business. And I finally got involved in the insurance business.
How did that come about?
Originally, it came about because a cousin of mine, Louis Statt, introduced me to a man who was with the USF&G, very nice man who had just come to Wilmington, and they gave me a job. It wasn't a job. I was a commissioned salesman, and they gave me a desk. And if I went out and I sold.
You sold insurance.
On
what kind of insurance?
Fire and casualty insurance.
And ultimately, you ended up in that business.
Yes. And I am to this day. That was in July, the end of July of 1940. So at this taping, it's just short of 45 years that I've been in this business.
All right. Well, now let's backtrack, because since we've investigated your business life and your employment life. Can you tell me what you've done in terms of your business, the growth of your business, how you started, and what it encompasses today?
Well, I started by necessity as nothing. I had no capital at all, And I went to a cousin of mine who was the president or vice president of a bank. And I needed some very modest initial capital. And I wanted to borrow $200. And he looked at me, and he knew that I was reliable and honest, and I was his first cousin, and that I would work hard, and et cetera. And he got all done, and he said, if you'll get Uncle Max, which was Max Zutz, or Ed Colton, who was another uncle of mine, to endorse the note, I'll loan you the $200. So I was furious with him, but I had a little alternative, and I took it to both of them, and both of them, to their credit, told me to tell him to go to hell, and they would loan me the money. But I did not do that, and they both reluctantly, because they were more anxious to give me the money, they signed the note, and I borrowed the $200, and that was my beginning capital. And with that, I went in business, and...
Where was your first office?
I had an office in the USF&G in the Delaware Trust Building, and they just gave me a desk. And whatever, you know, support facilities that they could kind of arrange for me. I used to do my own typing. I went out and I sold insurance, came back, placed it, had an insurance policy typed up a bill, went out, delivered it, collected the money, deposited the premium. I was a one-man show. Not unusual, not very difficult, not unusual for the times or circumstances. And after a couple of years, I was doing much better, and I finally had a little cubicle of maybe 100 square feet, and I had got to the point of I actually employed a girl as a secretary, a nice young lady, who I paid all of $12 a week to. And that's how I started, and then I did better and ultimately moved out of their office, and I moved to 205 West 9th, which was the second floor over the home savings and loan, and I was there for a few years. And then by then I had grown, and I had a couple people working for me, and I moved to 905 Orange, and by then I had about the time 1950 rolled around, I had about 10 or 12 people. And then we moved to Delaware Avenue, and the business has grown. It's been very satisfying, and now we employ about 50 people, and we have a big organization, and we have offices in Philadelphia and in London, in addition to Wilmington. And I'm very pleased with what our progress has been in the business.
And what kind of insurance?
We still write property and casualty insurance, and we handle primarily large commercial accounts, and we have a direct connection in the Lloyd's market. As a matter of fact,
that's Lloyd's of London.
Lloyd's, and I am one of the first Americans who've ever become a member of Lloyd's. And I have been a member of Lloyd's for many years, and to this day, I still travel back and forth. And I have very good connections in London, and we do a very big job there. We've had lots of opportunities of enlarging our business by merging or selling out, and I guess my ego is such that I wouldn't do it.
Are there any large accounts that you are particularly proud of, or stories that you'd like to recall?
Well, it's hard to believe that living in Wilmington, Delaware, I was able to, develop contacts that led us into what's used in the vernacular as the big time. We insured locally in Delaware. The largest account that we had at the time was International Latex in Dover. And I followed some of the same people that were at International Latex, who were very talented, and they went on to much bigger things, and as they went, I went with them. And we wound up, we had Revlon for many years, 22 years, so we insured, had them as a client. We insured Seagram's worldwide for about 12 or 13 years. And I got to know some very, very interesting, talented, controversial people. Sam Bronfman of Seagram's is a legend unto himself, and Charles Repson is, and some of the people that worked there. And that was a fascinating but very difficult experience, demanding, but we handled it.
Why do you think they allowed your service why they used your service? What did you offer that others didn't?
Well, in the privacy of this tape, we did a very good job. And this was not something that was ever handed to us. We were competing against the major insurance brokers in the United States, and we beat them. And there was really nothing more than that. We beat them. Mm. We beat them at their own game, and we had to do it purely on merit, and it was never a handout, and it was never without it. Trials and tribulations every year, but for years, 22 years in the case of Revlon, that we were able to prevail. So we obviously did a very good job. And it was notwithstanding the fact that in most of these cases, the proprietor, while he was called the CEO, he was in effect the proprietor. I'm talking about both Bronfman and Repson. We were relegated to dealing with a vice president or a treasurer. And in one case, we dealt with 11 vice presidents in 13 years. But we stayed. So I thought that was pretty good. In Delaware, we have some very large accounts. So we've been insuring the Delaware River Bay Authority, as an example, since 1952. Brandywine Raceway. But Zelaya Brothers, which used to be a very large account in Delaware. But we have had our fair share of large business, and we do a lot of business in Pennsylvania.
Are you involved in any other financial enterprises?
Yeah, I've been involved in real estate ventures, and with a group of others, we were the first ones that built with our own funds an office building ever in the city of Wilmington. We built the Bank of Delaware building, and at 300 Delaware Avenue, and we risked a great deal at that point, and there were seven of us, and we risked it at the time. We built the building, we got the Bank of Delaware as the partial tenant, and that was the first of the major office buildings we built in Wilmington. And with an associate, George Weiner, who's been very close to me, we own a lot of real estate in Wilmington. Primarily, we rebuilt the 200 block West 9th Street, which, while this may sound egotistical, was the forerunner of the Market Street Mall, and indeed, in itself, much more successful. It was self-serving, but it worked very well.
Let's go back now to some of your civic activities that you were involved in. In the earlier part of your life, I know that you were interested in many civic ventures. I think you were involved in some community activities.
Well, I've always been involved, as others in our family have always been involved in communal activities, and I was very much involved in B'nai B'rith, because I thought they were, among Jewish organizations, by far the premier service organization that there was, and I ultimately became the president of B'nai B'rith. And at another period in time, I was and I have a continuing interest in the Jewish Community Center, and I wound up being president of the Jewish Community Center. We had at one time in Wilmington the leading service organization that was kind of like a Jewish Kiwanis or Rotary, and it was called the
Avoda Club,
which means a Jewish word which means service, and I was actually president of that too. And but I've been involved, and I was president of the community association in which I lived, and of a country club, and
the Brandywine Country Club.
Yes, but these were things that I have an abiding interest in. I have an abiding interest in politics, and I've been active in Democratic politics.
Would you like to tell us something about your where your interest in politics has taken you? When did you first become interested, and what were some of the activities you participated in?
I think my interest in politics stems from the fact that as Jews, we were, in effect, second-class citizens. And there was only an opportunity, if we took the opportunity, of projecting ourselves in terms of active political organizations. And in view of the fact that the Democratic Party was closer to my views than the Republican Party, I became an active Democrat. And while I never ran for office, I would have liked to. I would have liked to participate in politics, but the financial cost involved were such that I couldn't do it. I was married, had a family. There was no way in the world that I could do that. So I helped others. And I was active in many political campaigns, and I thought that we did very well. I even ran a few people that, you know, my own expense for seats in the House and the State Senate in Delaware.
Would you like to tell some of the people that you...
Well, the first one I got involved with was Sam Sloan, who was a war veteran, and we thought on compassion alone he would win. He was a disabled American veteran and a very nice guy, and he lived on the east side of Wilmington, and we thought that he'd be a shoo-in. And we ran him, and to our chagrin, we lost. And then I got involved with a number of others, but not to that degree. We won some, we lost some, but in general...
Well, you mean you backed them financially?
Backed them. No, worked very hard. Worked very hard to help them, but they didn't win. But that never stopped me, and this was known as a Republican state. So we were a minority party, but we were trying very hard. Now, you know, looking back, unless those people are looking at the historical records, for example, Wilmington never had a Democratic mayor, except for one in the 30s. There was a fluke. Dr. Speer was a Democrat, but he was the only Democrat that we ever had. And it was a Republican state. And I was friendly with the Republican governors that we had. I was especially friendly with Walter W. Bacon, who was both city mayor in Wilmington and a governor. And he was an arch conservative, but a very nice man and a fine public official. These were all Republicans until Burt Carville came on the scene. And when he ran for his first term, I worked very hard for him, and he was, as many, many others did, and he was elected.
Did you support him financially?
Supported him to the degree that I could. Mm-hmm. And he was really a tribute to the state. And then when he ran again, he was defeated for re-election, but he did come back, and he was the only governor we've ever had, I believe, in the state that won a split term. And he won a second term, and the second term was in 1960, and he won, and he was a super governor. And it was under him that he asked me to serve as on the State Board of Education, which was a very distinctive honor because, number one, there's only five members of the State Board of Education. Number two, there had never been a Jew who had been served on the State Board of Education. And I served on that for 7 years. And it was very difficult. There was a great deal of bigotry.
What were the years?
1960 to 1967. seven. I might be wrong in those years. I have to check on that. Yeah. But it was about 7 years. I might be wrong. Maybe it was 66.
Well, that's all right. It's all
about.
Right. We, I mean, that can be.
Right. And I took my job very seriously. The the decision of Brown versus Board of Education had already been handed down, and that meant that segregated schools were a thing of the past. And when I came on the board, I decided that I ought to go see all the schools. Well, I couldn't get to see all the schools, but I tried. And I started out in Sussex County, and I went down there, and you might have thought they never heard of the Brown versus the Board of Education. They were still segregated schools. The white schools were lovely. The black schools were four-room schoolhouses with a potbelly stove and outdoor toilet facilities. And I was a stormy petrel. And the powers that were at that time certainly didn't like me. And the Delaware State News, to their everlasting discredit, printed cartoons on their editorial page of me after every meeting with a nose that you wouldn't believe, but at any rate, they were trying to make their point, and I was that upstart Jew who was the radical, etc. But it didn't make any difference, and I did my piece, and I thought that we did very well, and I thought that...
What did you attempt to do?
We attempted to literally end segregated schools. And I think to that degree we were actually successful because they finally got the message in Sussex County.
And you did this through equalization?
We did this through an equalization program in terms of all the districts. But the biggest contribution that we made was we got rid of, and I mean literally rid of, the state superintendent. Now, we forced his retirement, and then I became the chairman.
Who was the state superintendent?
I forgot his name at the moment,
but
I'll tell you who succeeded him. I was appointed as chairman of a committee to find his successor, and we interviewed people from all over the country, and there was a guy by the name of Boucher, and he had fantastic credentials. And they were so determined not to hire him that they tied our hands to the point of we could only offer $21,000 a year as the top salary. Now, there were teachers, there were principals, there were vice principals who were making more than he was. But at any rate, that's what they tied a salary to. And I talked to him personally, privately, and convinced him that his credentials would be enhanced much more than the money that was involved, and if he could hang in there, it would be in his best interest. Well, at any rate, he took it, and he came. And he drove them bananas for 3 years. And he redid our educational system, and I think that he is he's the kind of man that will not be recognized in the future as he should be, because he made a great impact on our Delaware school system. And I was delighted to have him. So I think that if there was one thing that I was responsible for in the school system in Delaware, it was changing the administrative level. Incidentally, as soon as they got rid of Boucher, they put back the fellow that they were anxious to have originally. But that's the way it was, and that's the way we ended.
Are there any other activities that you... can remember that you were involved in?
No, I think that the other activities were more pleasurable. I was involved in the country clubs
and
things such
in
as
golf.
That. Yes, but that's a more selfish kind
but that happens to be one of your interests.
Yes, it is one of my interests.
Right.
I like to play golf, and I'm not very good at it, but that's something I do.
Let's go back a little bit to your family. You married when?
I married in 1943. I married Gladys Rich, whose family was also from Wilmington. Her father was a proprietor of large drugstores in Wilmington. They were of modest circumstances, or they had been of more affluent circumstances until, you know, the bad years came. And they were very nice people, lived here all their lives, and died in, right here in Wilmington.
And then you had two children.
I have two children. I have a daughter who was now, in 1985, she's 40 years old, and she went away to college, and she got her degree. She had several master's degrees, and then taught school, married, raised a family, and to my very pleasant surprise, when she was about 36 years old, decided she wanted to go back to school. She went back to law school and got her degree, and she has two children who are at this moment in time 13 and 17. And I have a son who went away to undergraduate school. He's very bright. He was a Phi Beta Kappa. He was a Rhodes Scholar candidate. And we paid for his education for the first year in undergraduate school. He was got scholarships. He applied to seven law schools. He was accepted to all seven. He finally ultimately went to Yale, after having turned down Harvard and Pennsylvania and Virginia and Michigan, and et cetera. And he came back and he decided he really didn't want to practice law. He wanted to be a professional golfer. And at any rate, he took 2 years off at that. And then he decided he couldn't make it as a professional golfer. He's a good golfer, but not good enough. And he went back and he practiced law. And he's involved in our operation now, and he's doing very well. And he handles a phase of the business that deals with malpractice insurance.
Thank you very much for this interview.